This is John Quinn, and this is Law Disrupted. And today we're talking to Christine Lehman of the Reichman Jorgensen Lehman and Feldberg Law Firm. Christine is based in their Washington, D.C. office. They recently have gotten a very large verdict in a patent case against Amazon Web Services, a $525 million patent verdict. And Christine, I know because our firm, as you know, participates in the patent wars, and getting a verdict that size against one of the large tech companies, well, that doesn't happen every day. And that's the large tech companies, our experience is kind of fight you to the very end, and at trial they show up and they hire lawyers that know how to try patent cases. And winning a verdict like that is really quite an accomplishment. So first, let me congratulate you.
Thank you.
Tell us, who was your client and what was the technology at issue?
Sure. So our client was Cove. It's a small company in Chicago. And John Overton is the head of Cove, and he was one of the inventors of the patents we asserted. And the technology had to do with sort of the way cloud storage works, especially at scale, and how it works in an efficient and really functional way now that AWS is, and you know, others with like a really large cloud storage business have to store just huge amounts of data.
Right. And so this technology really went right to the heart of Amazon Web Services?
It really did. Yeah. I mean, it's really a fundamental advancement in the technology. So this was not a case about, you know, some little added feature. This really went to the absolute basics of their technology and what they do.
I mean, are there, if you can answer this, are there similar potential claims against other large cloud service providers, the, you know, Googles of the world and the Microsofts of the world?
Yeah, there is a pending case, I can say. There is a pending case against Google. And, you know, obviously we think this technology is really remarkable and very important to the cloud storage industry. So we'll see.
All right. So tell us about your client. What was your client's background? How did your client come up with this invention? I know those invention stories are always important to jurors in patent cases because often the inventor and the invention story is one of the few things in a patent case maybe that jurors who don't have technical backgrounds can relate to.
Yeah. And this actually, there was an amazing story here. And it was very much not, I don't think it was appreciated by anyone completely until we got to trial. I mean, even, you know, our client, you know, grew up in Kentucky and ended up like, you know, maybe not doing the best in school, maybe like getting a little distracted by other things, kind of fighting his way through, but found a professor who sort of believed in him and that he could do more. And it happened to be a professor of religion. So he went on and studied religion. You know, he ended up going to Harvard. He ended up being in a PhD program in the University of Chicago and studying sort of religion. But also semiotics, which is actually a study of sort of signs that are sort of fundamental to sort of religion and history of religion and history of civilization. But it's actually some of the same fundamentals as computer science. And so, I mean, our inventor, I mean, Mr. Overton is sort of had been, his background had been a little dismissed during the case as like, oh, well, he's like a religion major. Really? You're telling me he invented this amazing technology? Well, yeah, he actually did.
I mean, the other side, the defendants, I can see them thinking, yeah, religion major, a kid with a troubled background from Kentucky. This isn't going to suggest that he would come up with some brilliant earth-changing invention. Whereas it kind of sounds like the way this played out with the jury, that was something that they could relate to and empathize with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it really was, he had an amazing story. And we had his co-inventor, who had a more traditional like PhD in computer science that he had met at University of Chicago, who was still like a good friend of his, and came back and was able to also explain, like, they worked in sort of the, you know, computer support office at University of Chicago together. And he was able to say, yeah, I might have been a little skeptical. This guy was from the religion department comes in to work here, but he was immensely talented. And it was sort of out of that relationship. I mean, they ended up starting a company, and it was, you know, it was a little too early for the technology.
When are we talking about? What year?
Oh, gosh.
Long before Amazon Web.
Yeah, like 90s, like well before. Yeah, so it was in the like 90s time frame. And John had come up with this idea, and he'd come up with this concept for just figuring out a way to like index all the information. And he had been, it kind of came to him thinking about, he had tons of pictures. He had sort of taken a year and decided to ride his bicycle across the United States. He had just tons and tons of pictures. And he was like, well, maybe there was a way to sort of index them, like not store all the pictures, but just take a little bit of information from all the pictures and organize them in some way. But then maybe you could take that and organize all the information in the entire world. And he came up with this concept, and then he went to Steph to help figure out how to implement it. They worked together. They came up with the concept. They started a company. They got a whole bunch of excitement in the Chicago venture capital world. They had like these great meetings, and then they're meeting with people and they're like, our technology can store, you know, millions and millions of objects. But you know, one of the Crate and Barrel is a big Chicago presence, and the founder of Crate and Barrel was there. It was like, we only have like 100,000 items. Like, we don't need that much information storage. And, you know, it ended up that the company, you know, failed because nobody needed this level of storage at the time.
Right.
So they ended up, John like purchased, Mr. Overton, he purchased the patents out of the kind of bankruptcy when the whole company was closing, winding down, and held on to them because he really believed in it. I mean, it really was sort of his first, you know, big idea, but by necessity went on and developed other technologies, which his company Cove is like working on now. But, you know, but that can be a challenge when you're asserting a patent as a plaintiff, because you have this story, but, you know, they weren't successful.
They had tried to commercialize it and succeeded. What you're saying, it was maybe too early. By the time the technology developed, whether you could have such a thing as storage in the cloud, and Amazon famously really commercialized that first, at that point, their claim was ripe, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. So it became, you know, right, many years later.
So what was the, I mean, have had other market participants taken licenses on the patent?
No, there are no licenses.
That's interesting. And that's kind of unusual, isn't it, for an important patent like that?
Yeah, no, it is a little unusual. But, you know, it really was, you know, this case has been pending for a long time. Was filed in 2018.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. 2018, and you just got the verdict like a month ago or something like that.
Right, yeah, in April of 2024.
What was going on all that time? Almost 6 years.
Yeah, well, a lot of things. You know, as is typical in these cases, when you have a defendant that has a lot of money, they challenge and delay the case any way they can. So there was, they filed an IPR, but that was not instituted. And then there were several re-exams because, you know, you can file these ex parte re-exams at the patent office, and there's no estoppel effect. There's no limit on the number that you can file. So they could just keep filing re-exams. And between that and just the pandemic slowdown, you know, 6 years went by pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And so this case went to trial in Chicago. There aren't that many, my impression is there aren't that many patent cases on the docket in the federal court in Chicago.
Yeah, there aren't. And I'm not sure why. I mean, other than, you know, maybe there aren't as many companies there to bring lawsuits. But I mean, Chicago does have a thriving tech community. And, you know, and Cove and Dr. Overton had been there since his University of Chicago days. We felt like it was the right place to file. And, you know, it might not have been as fast as maybe other districts. We found that the case proceeded, you know, other than the sort of delays for the pandemic and the stays for some of the re-exam issues, went quickly, and we got, you know, very reasoned decisions all the way through and, you know, an excellent jury pool.
Were there some pretrial events which really you think turned out to be significant in shaping the trial and ultimately the outcome?
Yeah, there were a number. I mean, we definitely approached these really, you know, big, complex patent cases with a long game in mind. I mean, this case, there's a lot of work that went into this case over several years. You know, both there were battles over, you know, claim construction that had been done years ago, but for summary judgment, there were some excellent rulings for us at summary judgment. And then Daubert motions in limine, those, that practice has become so crucial, especially in these courts like Chicago, Delaware, and California, where you're getting these very analytical judges that are going to look very hard at the evidence. And, you know, they will let you go to trial, but only if, you know, you are meeting every single requirement. So we found that that pretrial practice has just become hugely important in actually getting these cases to trial.
But obviously you were able to get your key expert opinions through the Daubert challenge process.
Yeah, we were, and that was due to a lot of planning, frankly. I mean, obviously the damages verdict was very large in this case, and I mean, part of that was just due to the revenue at stake. There are very large numbers involved. But we also very deliberately, and it might have been a little tedious to the jurors at some point, but we built a very detailed case with our technical expert about, you know, what the advantages were of the patented technology. We had an industry expert to help and explain the benefits of the invention. And then, of course, our damages or economic expert, you know, quantified those in economic terms. So, you know, we really wanted to make sure we had everything buttoned up. And so, yeah, all of our key expert opinions survived Daubert and motions to eliminate practice.
Did the defense challenge both validity and infringement?
Well, you know, strangely, just shortly before trial, and this has happened to us how a couple times in patent cases, the other side emailed and said, we're not going forward with invalidity. And I, of course, had already spent weeks studying the invalidity expert reports, and I was going to cross the invalidity expert. So part of me was disappointed, part of me a little relieved. But it, I don't know, it was an interesting strategy. I was perfectly happy with it.
Why do you think they decided not to challenge validity?
I really was scratching my head on that one a little bit.
There can be a tension. There can be a tension between infringement and validity.
There can, but it's sort of hard to give up. I mean, I think there's also something that we've seen defendants in patent cases argue that they will drop invalidity as a defense, so they aren't stuck with that clear and convincing invalidity evidentiary threshold that sounds very serious and hard to meet. And then they might still argue more qualitatively in terms of the infringement case and the damages case of like, this patent's not worth very much. this patent's only a small improvement. Oh, you know, there was a lot of other stuff in the art out there, you know, and even in this case, although they had, you know, they'd waived their invalidity defenses, they still crossed our inventor that, oh, well, you know, you didn't invent all cloud storage, right? You didn't invent this. You didn't invent this. You didn't invent this. So I think it is something that plaintiffs have to be just careful to watch. Like, even though somebody might drop invalidity as a defense, it doesn't mean they might not make kind of a collateral attack on it.
Mm-hmm. So who was your first witness?
It was John Overton.
Okay.
You know, it's his company. Kid from Kentucky.
The kid from Kentucky. Yeah. How long was he on direct, and then how long was he on cross?
Gosh, the first witness, it always seems like it's a little longer, a little under an hour on direct.
That's not very much.
Yeah. I mean, sort of went through a story. Well, you know, in all these cases these days, Judge Kennelly gave us a good amount of time, but we still had to watch our minutes pretty carefully. Yeah. So
you had a clock, both
yeah,
sides.
Yeah, we had a clock, you know.
And how much time did both sides have?
Oh, I'm gonna forget. Asking yeah. Details.
Well, how long was the trial?
We ended up being about 9 days, 10 days. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Went to verdict on the 10th day. So we just had to be careful of our time, which, you know, is fine. That's, all the judges do that now, and we understand for the efficiency, reasons. Judge Kennelly is extremely efficient, with the use of court time. So, you know, we just went through the facts. I mean, we put up, Dr. Overton, testified first, you know, was able to tell his story. And in the cross, you know, I don't even really remember even how long it was.
What do you think, do you recall, were there any points in the trial which you thought were really telling or turning points, or you, on reflection, you thought were really significant?
Well, I mean, one of the remarkable things that Judge Kennelly will do, if the parties agree, is he suggested at our pretrial conference, he's like, well, I will give the jurors an opportunity to ask questions of each witness. If you both agree, and the way the procedure works is a witness will go up, they'll testify on direct, cross, redirect. Then I'll ask the jurors if they have any questions. They can write down question on the pads of paper they have. The notes will get passed. They are given to the judge. And then at sidebar, we go over the notes. And if we all are okay with the questions, you know, then the judge will read the juror questions to the witness. And I've never seen it done before. And the other side agreed at the pretrial conference, and we just asked, we're like, Judge, can we just have a day to think about this? And one of our attorneys had clerked for a judge who also used this process. And she said, do it. It's super helpful. And so we agreed. It's a little scary. You know, your witness is up there.
Right.
It was amazing.
How so?
The jurors were paying such good attention. They absolutely, like, they were asking, like, the detailed, technical, like, get-to-the-point questions. It honestly, I mean, you could ask judges all the time to do this. And it also, it helped both sides, because you knew what the issues were. If there was an issue they were confused about, you knew. If there was, you know, an issue they were interested in that they really didn't need to worry about, like, you knew, and then even the judge could sort of explain it. It was really phenomenal. I mean, we had them ask a question, I think it was of our, like, technical expert who was on the stand the first time for, like, for just hours and hours and hours, marching through all of our infringement evidence. And, you know, those direct infringement exams of experts can get a little long and a little dry sometimes. this jury was paying such close attention. I mean, they asked questions after his exam, and they like zeroed right in on like what the key points were. It was phenomenal.
Could there be any follow-up? You know, the juror has a question. You all agree that it'll be given to the witness. The judge reads it. The witness gives an answer. Could there be follow-up? Could the judge ask follow-up or the jurors? Or
The judge would ask the lawyers if they had any follow-up. And yeah, it was really, you know, and it was even if, you know, you're asking a witness question and they're sort of dancing around the answer. And
that's revealing.
Yeah. And so it's always revealing. But yeah, the jury was paying such close attention. They could tell if a witness was like dancing around, kind of refusing to answer. And then the jury asked the question. And then the witness would just turn and answer the question straight up. It was amazing. It's an amazing procedure. I absolutely heartily endorse it.
Well, in a case like this, where the technology is so complex, the lawyers always worry about, well, how do we explain this? And you obviously had a jury that was really paying attention. But were there some things that you did that you thought were effective to make the technology understandable?
I mean, we of course, you know, worked on sort of developing ways to explain it for a long time. I mean, in every patent case, you know, you think about analogies within the team and then you shoot them all down because they all have problems. But in the end, you know, we, as the plaintiff, really sort of spent just a huge amount of our time explaining the technology when our experts were first got on the stand, like, just going through the fundamentals of the technology. What are we talking about? How does this work? Before we jumped into the claim by claim analysis. So, you know, that time is precious, but we felt like it was worth it. It was a worthwhile investment to make sure the jury understood and had some context for everything that was about to come. I mean, you know, we used slides, of course, but it was interesting. The other side did not.
Did not use slides in their presentation?
No.
That's pretty unusual.
It was very unusual. And so even when they had they had some technical fact witnesses, they had engineers from AWS come and testify, and they wanted them to explain how the system worked. And they had them draw on like an electronic tablet that was hooked up to the court's AV system, so it would show up on the screen. And so they were like hand drawing, like, you know, these are this different parts of like how the information flows on this kind of hand drawn sketch. And again, I've not seen it before. As someone who had sort of studied the technology to get ready for trial, I found it a little difficult to follow. So I'm not sure what their intent was there, but it was a little confusing.
Yeah. What was the law firm that represented AWS?
It was Fish Sigler. They're based here in DC.
Mm-hmm. You got a $525 million verdict. Is that what you asked for, or had you asked for a different number?
We had asked for a range. You know, our damages analysis tried to isolate the incremental profit that was due to the patented inventions. And so we had found that the incremental profit was a little over $1 billion. And then our economic expert went through and sort of explained this was a reasonable royalty case, the hypothetical negotiation, and so how that profit split would work. And so we had asked for a profit split of sort of at least 50%. So an exact 50% profit split was like 517, 518. I don't know. They rounded that to 525.
Yeah. Well, you don't have the money in the bank account yet. I mean, we all know there's post-trial motions, and any multi-hundred million dollar verdict, it's going to get close scrutiny on appeal, and a lot of those get taken away one way or another, sent back for retrial. So what are your feelings? Well, let me stop and ask first, was there any settlement discussions? Can you talk about that at all?
I don't know if I can talk about that.
Right. Okay.
But
you've got more, if there are any such hypothetical settlement right. discussions, you've got some more arguments to make now.
Right. Hypothetically, any settlement discussions, you know, certainly you would hope they would be helped by this. But, you know, I mean, the number is big. And I'm certainly aware of what's happened to a lot of big verdicts at the federal circuit. And, you know, we'll have to see how all of the post-trial briefing and appeal goes, of course. But, you know, this case, we knew from the beginning that there would be big numbers involved just because of the accused product. So we really tried to tie down all the analysis and all the numbers in as many ways as we could. And, you know, and I think the fact that this is a case coming after, you know, years of litigation, multiple patent office proceedings, lots of scrutiny, claim construction, Daubert, pretrial motions of all kinds, that, you know, we feel like the whole case is already.
You've got a good record. A lot of judges have looked at this, and this patent has seen a lot of scrutiny, and you've got a verdict now.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Thank you for joining us today. And good luck in the post-trial motions and on appeal.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Christine Lehman, who with her team has just within the last month won a $525 million verdict in a patent case against Amazon Web Services. This is John Quinn, and this is Law Disrupted. Thank you for listening to Law Disrupted with me, John Quinn. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a rating and review on your chosen podcast app. To stay up to date with the latest episodes, you can sign up for email alerts at our website, law-disrupted.fm, or follow me on X at JBQLaw or at Quinn Emanuel. Thank you for tuning in.